Hello and welcome to this edition of the Cultural Colchester podcast. I'm Tim Young and I have another great guest with me today. And I will now introduce a man who is a writer, a director, an actor, a reviewer, a critic, and it is... Dr. Paul T. Davis. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Tim.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, let's get this doctor business out of the way first. You're not a doctor of medicine, I'm presuming.
No, I can't heal you physically.
I don't think anybody could.
I can heal your soul via the arts.
So what are you? Are a doctor of?
My subject was, I was one of the first people to write about theatre that dealt with AIDS and HIV. So the title of my PhD is Days Gone By, AIDS, Queer Theory and Theatrical Discourses, 1983 to 1994.
And when did you do that?
I graduated in, I think, about 2005. I did it via the University of East Anglia when I was working at Suffolk College, which it was then. And it took me 10 years to do it because I did it part-time. But when you teach, obviously the demands of teaching take over and I had to take time out. But it's one of the things that I'm the most proudest
of. I'm sure. Oh, brilliant. Perhaps I could read it at some point.
Well, you can. It's a page turner.
And while we're on that subject, and I didn't plan to go into this necessarily, but this is the nature of this podcast. Let's talk about It's a Sin.
Oh, wonderful.
Groundbreaking piece of television, Russell T. Davis. I loved it. I know you loved it. Yeah. Tell me why you thought it was so good.
I thought it was good because of the honesty about the situations. I love stuff which is character-led rather than incident-led. And Russell T. Davis does create fantastic characters. And he felt, I read an interview in which he felt he needed 30 years to pass before he could write it. And that tied in with a quote that I heard recently from the guy who created Horrible Histories. Because I saw him being interviewed and they said to him, is Terry something his name is? They said to him, there must be loads of history that's horrible that you can write about now. And he said, no, you don't write about it now because we're in the middle of the tornado. We're in Kansas. When you get to Oz, then you can look back at Kansas. And I think that's what Russell T. Davis did with It's a Sin. And
did it capture the time?
It did. I was in Cardiff at the time.
Right.
And I was studying my first degree. And this is why I wrote my PhD, really, because it's over here. It was about 1985 that we became aware and things like that. And my... obviously, I still observe confidentiality after all this time, but my drama lecturer died of AIDS. I also have friends who died of AIDS. And I saw the play The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer.
I remember that.
Which really opened my eyes. A really influential play for me is Angels in America by Tony Kushner. But more importantly, it led me to volunteer for Cardiff AIDS Helpline. And there are scenes in It's a Sin, which I've done, because I buddied somebody who died from AIDS. This is why Be More Jill really appeals to me, because a lovely friend of mine from Cardiff who knew me at the time, she messaged me to say, I keep telling everyone that you're Jill. And my response was, well, part of me was Jill, but I was also some of the other characters as well. And I just think he captured the terror of the time.
Yeah, and the ignorance.
And the ignorance. And hopefully we've said goodbye to those days.
Some of them, let's hope so, yeah.
But hopefully there are more Jills. And I think the last year has shown that there are much more Jill characters.
And if you haven't watched it yet, I presume it's still out there on,
it's on all four.
Yeah. So please watch it. It's absolutely brilliant. It's
but you will need tissues.
Oh, you will need lots. And it's hilarious. Yeah. And it's brilliant. And before we leave the subject, I think we must both say la.
La?
La. Okay. So you've talked a bit there about your background. You're a very proud person of Wales.
Yes. A person of Wales.
Or a Welshman.
Yeah, or a Welshman, indeed.
So tell us where you grew up and how, through that, you got into your career. Because it's not the obvious career choice. Are you from the Valleys?
I'm from the Valleys. I'm from a small town called Bargoed, which is about 17 miles from Cardiff. But could really be much further because it's, you know, it was a very quiet, kind of enclosed valleys town, a former mining town. You know, I was born and bred there, basically. There was never any culture, I suppose, in my family. And honestly, I still consider I'm a bit of a freak, really. My first love was books. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when I first kind of escaped into my imagination by reading books. And it was only I was about 15, and I had two. Everyone has teachers that they always remember. Yeah. And I had Judith Jones, who was the drama teacher, and Mrs. Bird, who was the English teacher. Mm-hmm. And they kind of must have seen some potential in me, and I got cast in the school play, and that was it. I was Mr. Collins in Pride and Prejudice. So I was the vicar.
Yes, the creepy vicar.
The creepy vicar, yeah, which was a great part. But my biggest triumph was the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, I can imagine. Oh, the following that. Year.
And I suppose now is a good time to return to that role. I just had a great time. And then, like a lot of people, I didn't really know what to do with myself.
Some of us still don't.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get into drama school, and I know now perfectly well why, because I was just hopeless. But I did work for a few years, and I joined Everyman Theatre in Cardiff, which I always call it my drama school. Because they were professional directors, they were professional actors who, when they were resting, would work with Everyman Theatre.
What did you do there?
My first show was Cider with Rosie, which we all played the kids as well. So I played the 10-year-old child and then other roles. So that was a multi-roling part. In the open air, Shakespeare's, I was Thisbe in Midsummer Night's Dream. But I also did props and backstage and kind of learnt my craft.
And is that where you learnt to love theatre?
Yeah, really fell in love with it then. Because unless you're encouraged, I think a lot of people don't realise that they can do it. Mm-hmm. And you've really got to overcome that fear of walking on stage and making a fool of yourself, basically. But that was kind of my drama school. And then in my mid-20s, I decided to leave the Artificial Limb and Appliance Centre, which is where I worked at the Welsh office in Cardiff.
Sounds fascinating.
It was a great job. Go and do a humanities degree.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't just want to be a theatre person. So 9 subjects kind of narrowed down to your specialist subjects in the third year. Mm-hmm. And I chose to do theatre. And then, and this will segue nicely into this podcast, I came to Colchester to do my MA in theatre in 1988 at University of Essex.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm an alumni of Essex
University. Oh, my God. We're learning so much about all my guests here during this podcast, and I didn't know that. And so, yeah, you did your MA. So who were your lecturers at Essex?
Roger Howard and others that I've forgotten then.
I'm sure Roger, if he's still about, will be resonant with a lot of people who had him as their lecturer. And so you came to Colchester then.
Yeah.
What made you stay?
Well, I... I had a brilliant year doing my MA. It was very intense. I think anyone who's done any kind of higher degree, to do it full time in a year, I was quite confident I could get my BA. I honestly did not know whether I would get that MA. It was intellectually for me then very challenging because there wasn't a huge practical element to the course then. And there was either an MA in drama or an MA in Shakespeare then. There wasn't the fantastic range they have now. And I went back to Wales after the year, but I'd made really good friends in Colchester. And there's Harry Harris is one of my best and oldest friends. And he's the technical manager at Lakeside Theatre at the university now. But I first met him when I was doing my MA. And I went back to Wales and I was asked by my first institution, the Polytechnic of Wales, as it was then, whether I would cover maternity leave and do some lecturing. And that's when I discovered that I could actually teach. And I did job, mainly I worked to pay off my MA loan. And then I was asked to do some teaching at the Welsh College of Music and Drama, which was great. And then I can tie this in with what we were first discussing, actually, because when I was buddying the person with AIDS, I had 5 interviews for lecturing posts around the country and came second 5 times. I got down to the last 2. And then, unfortunately, the person that I was buddying did die of pneumonia officially. And then my next job interview was at Suffolk College and I got it. And I think everything happens for a reason. And I think I was meant to stay in Cardiff.
For that
4 years or whatever. And then in 94, I got the job at Ipswich. But because I knew people in Colchester, I thought, I'm going to live in Colchester again. And I'm still
drawn
here.
Back to East Anglia.
Because it's a great town.
It is a great town. Before we get on to why it's a great town, and the hub of this podcast is, why is Colchester a cultural capital? We'll get into that in a minute. But I don't know anybody, and I do know a lot of people who love the theatre and love the arts and love show business, but I don't think I know anybody who loves them more than you.
Oh, right.
So you don't come from a theatrical family.
No, not at all.
Or a background. So what was it? What was it in little Paul Davis that attracted him to theatre?
Oh, that is a huge question. I think initially, if I go back to school, I mean, I was bullied for being too tall, basically.
You are very tall.
Everyone who knows me knows that I'm 6'8". I am Richard Osman.
That makes you a foot taller than me.
Right. It also makes your doorways really difficult to get under. But I was bullied a lot in school, and I discovered if I could make people laugh, that tended to diffuse it a little bit. And this might sound quite corny. It was being somebody else.
Yeah.
That attracted me to acting, that I could pretend. And because I've always had an active imagination, overactive, as I've been told several times, it was escaping into being somebody else. But also, if you do it well, you gain a bit of respect as well. And I had fantastic mentors, you know, and a lot of them have been female. My drama teacher, my English teacher, the women at Everyman Theatre in Cardiff, some of the best directors I've ever had have been female. And they taught me everything about theatre because they loved theatre. And, yeah, I suppose it does border on obsession sometimes. But I think my love of theatre has grown because it's kind of always changed because, you know, the respect that I have for actors and for other writers has grown because I know how difficult it is to do it.
Yeah.
But I think I also like the community, the supportive aspect of theatre. And I was out when I was teaching, I didn't really have time to do any outside production. It's only really since in 2010 the course at Suffolk was axed and I was made redundant. And I suppose the one thing that's come out of that is that I decided to pursue my own creativity a bit more.
So let's go into that then. Because you are a very, very good writer. You know I love your stuff.
Thank you.
And it's been put on a number of times in Colchester and throughout. Well, you've been to Edinburgh and London and wonderful places around this region as well. When did you think, I can write something. I can write something that can be performed. Because that's a leap, isn't it?
It is. One of the three productions that I did when I was teaching at Suffolk was a show called Triptych, in which it was work inspired by Francis Bacon. Mm-hmm. And there was a dance element to it and a filmed element, and they wanted a spoken word element, hence the triptych of performance. And a colleague of mine who's created it asked me if I would write something to perform it myself. And I wrote this kind of performance poetry thing about my responses to the Francis Bacon paintings. And that went down really well. And I kind of just potted then with writing my own things. And I suppose it's midlife crisis, really. I just... You know, if you're made redundant just before you're 50, what do you do? I know, I'll write plays and I'll see if I can put them on or convince somebody else to put them on. And I still consider myself to be a new writer.
Right.
Because 10 years or so is nothing in the scale of writing.
What was your first play?
First proper play was The Green Room, which I did at Headgate, which was three interlinked monologues about performing arts people. So I was kind ripping off Alan Bennett as well, because Talking Heads I was a big fan of.
Yeah.
And then for the Pulse Festival at the Woolsey in Ipswich, I wrote Downtown, which was like an LGBTQ farce, because of my PhD as well. I'd read and seen a lot of heavy stuff about being gay, but I wanted to celebrate it. Mm-hmm. And I set myself the challenge of seeing if I could write that kind of sitcom farce thing.
Yeah.
And then I always tell people I don't go looking for the next play. The next play finds me. And I think it's true for any writer. The more that you see your work on, the more you realise, oh, that doesn't work. Or no, that's quite good. So you find your voice, really. You find your writer's voice. And I think I've found it now. Mm-hmm. And I just keep chipping away at it, really.
And probably your best known work is Living with You.
Yeah.
So how did you get into wrestling?
Well, I mean, again, by not looking for it. Yeah. Steve Hannum, who writes Living with Luke, the blogs, it's about his difficult relationship with his autistic son, Luke, who at the time was a teenager, and Steve felt that Luke was disappearing from him. And it's a blog about the challenges of being a man and a father. We have a mutual friend who was reading the blogs, and on Facebook I started reading them. And I contacted Steve and I said, I'd like to have a go at adapting your blogs into a play. And I remember saying, I don't know what format that will be, but it won't be a monologue, because you may as well just walk on stage and read your blogs out loud. And then we became friends, and looking through his Facebook profile, you know, when you become friends with somebody, you just have a nose. I discovered Steve was a semi-professional wrestler back in the day. And I don't get many really, really good ideas. But I suddenly thought we could sit in a wrestling ring and he could wrestle autism to try and make contact with his son.
Which is brilliant.
And I may never get another brainwave like that, but he was up for it. We found wrestlers. We found a good cast. I had to go to wrestling shows and channeled my Nanny Davis, who used to love wrestling on a Saturday afternoon.
World of sport.
And wrestling is incredible. And one thing that you
just... It's like choreography, isn't it?
Well, it is. But also, as we know, as Steve found out in one performance, when his nose was a centimetre in the wrong place, so therefore he did get hit in the face by an armpit, and his nose started bleeding during his next monologue. If you're slightly out...
Yeah,
it's not fake. You do get hurt. And the amazing thing is that obviously it has a really butch image. Mm-hmm. Everyone was so, all these guys were so wonderful and supportive of the actual subject in the show. And it's what, 7 years ago we first premiered it at the Mercury.
Yeah.
We still get asked to do it. People still want to put it on.
I still haven't seen it.
And it's amazing that we're still friends, really, isn't it? But
So where did it go? Because it went quite wide.
Yeah, and it was picked up by a professional producer, and it went on a UK tour. Not a huge one. And every place we went to has now disappeared out of my head. But, you know, there were a few performances, and we learned a lot.
Went to Harlow, didn't it?
It's been to Harlow a few times because the family are from Harlow.
Yeah.
And one thing which the Harlow Playhouse invited us to do a pay what you can performance. We have raised thousands of pounds for charities that support families of autistic siblings and children. And I'm immensely proud of that. And Olivia and Luke hopefully will come back.
At some point, because you need to see it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so from Living with Luke, which was quite a hit, take us through your next folio of work.
Oh, gosh. I don't know if this is in the right order, but...
It doesn't have to be.
Play Something.
I saw Play Something.
Was a play about a gay relationship from the minute they meet to Till Death Do Us Part. Mm-hmm. And my idea for that was to have a DJ on stage. Because we all have our favourite songs that take us...
Don't say anything about favourite songs yet.
Right, that take us back to a time and a place. And we all have our song, you know.
Yeah.
And so at various points in their relationship, they would ask the DJ to play something to make love to, play something to fight to. And with the company, we worked out a playlist that kind of took us to the next chapter of their story. And I was really proud of that. And we took it to Edinburgh. And you have to fight for attention in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I have been.
But we had a really good run with really good houses.
Yeah.
And our fan from New York is still a fan of the show. Excellent. And I mean, in amongst that, there was Bury Me in Colchester Mud.
Brilliant.
Which
that
I
was
really
commissioned
enjoyed.
By a very far-sighted politician.
It was, yes, yes. I forget what his name was.
No, he's lost in the mists of time.
But I was really proud of that because for me to discover about Colchester during the siege and to research that and to bring, well, for me they were fictional characters because we don't know what happened to the citizens who were basically
they were
starved and they were under siege.
Yeah.
And I was
and
really
to have it
proud
it
of it.
St. Martin's was really
which is
good.
The actual site where people took refuge during the siege. So there was Play Something, Shedding Skin, which I did at the Mercury.
Yeah, which I also saw.
There's so many unproduced and unperformed plays.
And you know there's one that I'm particularly...
And I know there's one that you really are desperate to see performed.
Yeah, absolutely.
But my latest one is Jackie, in which...
Oh, yes. Tell us about Jackie.
Well... Harry Bowen is a local actor who is tremendous, and because of an accident, he is a wheelchair user.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing him in his college productions, I think, because the nice thing about being a reviewer is that I get to see lots of theatre. And I saw him in one of his degree shows in Romeo and Juliet, funny enough, at the at Lakeside. And I just remember thinking, I want to work with Harry one day. And separately in my mind, and it's amazing how these lived separately for so long, I've always been interested in wheelchair ballroom dancing and thinking it'd be nice to do a show about wheelchair ballroom. And then one day I suddenly put the two together and thought, I could ask Harry whether he wanted to work on creating a show. He loved the idea, so he actually learned how to do ballroom dancing thanks to Jane Hamblin, who runs Char-Char Chairs, which is for people who use wheelchairs who want to dance. And we did...
And is she locally based?
She's from Chelmsford Way. But
I don't mention Chelmsford on this podcast.
Well, not bad. It's through Dilek at the Mercury.
Oh, Dilek's lovely.
Who put us in touch with Jane. And we did a first showing at Lakeside in January 2020. And we are scheduled to be doing it at the Mercury this autumn, which will be a year later.
Very
thanks
exciting.
To the pandemic. But it is exciting. And the Mercury's been so supportive.
And in the new Mercury.
In the new Mercury, I can't
amazing.
Wait.
Amazing.
I'm trying not to be excited because we have to be cautious. But yeah. Like the Pointer Sisters, I am so excited.
Excellent. Okay, we're now reached the stage in the podcast interview where we go into Julie Andrews and the Sound of Music and a few of your favourite things.
Here we go.
So are you ready?
As ready as I'm going to be. So I have to respond quickly.
First thing that comes into your head, so it might not be, it's today.
Right.
It's a snapshot of your favourite things. Right, you ready?
Yeah.
Favourite play?
Angels in America, Tony Kushner.
Favourite playwright?
Alan Bennett.
Book?
Tales of the City, Armistead Maupin. Which is actually 9 volumes.
Okay. Don't know it, but
I'm, oh, you should.
We're going to make a list of all the favourite things of people, and then I'm going to have to return to them and look into them. Film?
Ooh, Pride. Welsh miners and LGBTQ support for the miners. It was strictly ballroom for many years. But Pride
is brilliant, yeah. TV show?
Adult or child?
You might have to elaborate on that.
As a child, Thunderbirds.
Okay.
As an adult, Detectorists.
Oh, yes.
Which I think I got you onto that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
If people haven't watched Detectorists,
go and watch it.
It's on Netflix.
Absolutely. Favourite actor or actress?
Oh, that's a hard one. Probably Judi Dench.
Yeah, Judi.
I like that generation, you know, Maggie Smith, Michael Gambon.
Yeah, now we come to the question that has been the most difficult for people.
Right.
Let's see how you get on. Favourite famous person with the name Paul?
Oh. Oh. It does
reaction.
Stump everybody. Paul Ritter died this week.
Yeah.
And in both Friday Night Dinner, he's so good in Chernobyl. I didn't realise it was him for 4 episodes or whatever. And I suddenly thought, he's in Friday Night Dinner.
He's the dad.
But I saw him on stage in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And he played the dad. He was absolutely beautiful.
So
I'm
going to
say Paul Ritter.
Yeah, great. Favourite rugby player?
You are. You're going to be surprised.
It's
do you mean as a rugby player or as I can?
First thing that came into your head.
Ben Curry. But in terms of rugby, it has to. Oh no, I can't. I can't name one. To be
you
honest,
you can't name a Welsh rugby player.
Dan Bigger.
Dan Bigger.
George North. Yeah, you know, I was trying to select which one.
But we're going with Ben Curry.
Okay. I'd love to go with Ben Curry.
favorite piece of music or song.
Song? Do you mean like a single?
Yeah.
Oh, it's Dancing Queen by ABBA.
Of course. And if I was to say piece of music?
I'm very fond of The Lark Ascending.
Oh, yeah.
By Vaughan Williams.
Yeah, even I know that.
So. It's absolutely beautiful. And I heard it on the radio during the eclipse. Do you remember the eclipse years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
We were in Devon visiting friends and it just came on Classic FM. Just for the eclipse happened.
Yeah, quite
and
moving, obviously.
Yeah, it was very moving.
Favourite sweets as a kid?
Oh, do you remember rhubarb and custard?
Oh, God, yeah.
Probably that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, nice. Yeah, you can probably still get them.
Yeah, probably.
And I always throw in a curveball at the end, but this isn't that much of a curveball for you. Favourite place in Wales?
Outside Cardiff, there is Dufferin House and Gardens.
Where's it? Just outside Cardiff.
It's and that's where Everyman Theatre used to do open air Shakespeare.
Might have to check that out. Because
there's
an the border.
But the gardens are wonderful. I think it's now the Botanical Gardens of Wales.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it's a little oasis.
Okay. Next time we're in the Cardiff area, I shall check that out. Okay. Well done. That is your favourite bit done. That's really interesting. I'm really loving those. So let's concentrate on Colchester just for a second. Why you think Colchester is this magnet, this attracts all these creative people, and why Colchester? Have you any idea?
I suppose like everyone, I've got a few theories and
ideas.
Because when I when I was made redundant, one of the first things I did was depot with Mercury Theatre.
Yes.
And that,
which is now student accommodation.
Yeah, but I mean,
Magdalen Street.
In terms of community, I'm still friends with people that, you know, we were in depot with.
Yeah.
And working with the Mercury and professional actors and designers and directors was amazing. I think, if I think about Cardiff was where I lived before I moved to Colchester. Colchester is a town that behaves as if it's a city. And I think it has that ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And the theatrical community in Colchester, I think, especially over the last few years, has become really strong. Because we're only an hour from London.
Yeah.
And the Mercury, I'm biased, but the Mercury is wonderful.
Mm.
And a lot of students go to Essex University to study drama.
Yeah.
The drama department is really well regarded, and Lakeside Theatre is a smashing resource. So you've got that, and you've got Headgate, which is the home of amateur theatre.
Yeah,
I can tell you, there's nothing amateur about Headgate most of the time.
No, indeed.
The work put on there,
except when I perform there.
we'll draw a curtain over that, Tim. And then you have the Arts Centre, which, you know, it goes for the more obscure type of theatre. Wonderful Wednesdays are truly wonderful because you never know what you're going to see. I think what's happened in the last few years is that as London has become more expensive, a lot of creative people have come to Colchester and stayed. I think I was probably a pioneer in that, actually.
I think you probably were.
Yeah, you know, 26 years ago, 27 years ago.
Absolutely.
But
we'll let you claim that.
People tend to come to Colchester and stay because of the cultural vibe of the town. I mean, musically, it's great as well.
Mm-hmm.
First Sight is somewhere that we always go to. And I tell you, when you discover how good Colchester is when a friend comes to stay. And everything that you take for granted, you start showing to these friends, and they go, well, this is amazing. Yeah.
Do you think the take it for granted business, which I totally agree with you about, do you think that will dissipate slightly as we come out of lockdown because we've missed it so much?
I think
so. And we won't take it for granted so much.
Well, hopefully not. I think everyone's realised how much we need live entertainment. Theatre that is screened and adapted for film is fine, but to me, it's not really theatre. For me, it's the live experience of experiencing something for the one and only time, because every performance is different,
mm-hmm.
with a group of people, and you respond collectively as a group. I think theatre's going to be a bit cautious when it comes back, both in terms of what is put on, but also audiences might feel a bit cautious at first. But every theatre I know, the Headgate in particular, I've been working with, is working so hard on COVID secure environment as much as possible. And I'm sure everywhere else will as well. So I don't think people will take for granted that live experience anymore. But I think after the initial caution is over with, what I'm hoping for is that there'll be a bit of an explosion about live arts and not just theatre.
I think you're right.
But music and everything. And Colchester has the facilities to do that from a so-called amateur level at Headgate through to touring companies that are going to be coming to the Mercury.
Outside venues like the Castle Park or Leolani.
Absolutely.
Dedham, there's loads of places around Colchester.
I don't think we've begun to tap the potential of outdoor sites
so exciting,
in Colchester.
I think you're right, and we'd encourage people to go and see as many of these things when they open up again as they can. Now, I've been fortunate enough to accompany you on a couple of occasions, if not more, to shows that you've reviewed.
Yes.
Because I think, well, tell us that the one. What is your record of shows you've seen in a year?
Oh, what year are we in? In 2019, which is the year before it all went wrong, I think I saw 147 productions.
Amazing.
But most of them I'd reviewed.
Yeah.
And a stupid amount.
How did you get into reviewing?
Neil Darcy Jones, the legend that is Neil Darcy
Jones.
He is
going to be on this podcast.
He asked me whether I would do a review for Richard III, which Priory Players were doing outside the castle, open air. And I wrote it, and Neil liked it, and said, would you be interested in doing more? And that's how I started reviewing for the Gazette.
Mm-hmm.
With the focus being on that, I would review amateur theatre. Yeah. But then gradually, because, you know, Neil did everything and couldn't make a lot of shows, I would then go and review some of the professional shows. And BritishTheatre.com were looking for reviewers about 7 years ago. So mm-hmm. I sent my CV and started reviewing for them. So then my reviewing went nationally.
Yeah.
And this is why I saw so many productions at the Edinburgh Festival, because
you
know, my record was 8 in one day, and I don't think I'll ever do that again. Because by number 8, I didn't know what I had seen. And, of course, you have to write up every review. But it does mean that I've seen an awful lot of theatre.
Including London shows, I think.
London West shows, End. Yeah. West End and Fringe.
Yeah. Yeah. And what amazed me when I've been to you and you're reviewing a show is you watch the show.
Yeah.
You don't take notes.
No, I don't.
Which is amazing.
And there are two types of critics.
I mean, you and I talked afterwards.
Yeah.
And then you wrote the review. And it was though you had taken notes. So you must have a great memory, or you just focus in.
I think you have to give respect to the people who are on stage. But there are two types of critics. Those who watch, I might scribble things in the interval. Or if I've been to London, I make my notes on the train coming home.
Right.
And those critics who have a notepad with a torch, which is very distracting for the audience and also for the people on stage. And I didn't make a conscious decision, but from the very first thing that I reviewed, I watched. And as long as I have a program and I can get people's names spelt correctly and which part they were playing,
very important,
because that is very important, as I found to my cost several times, I would try and record the show in my memory. And my thing is, I don't write the review on the night that I saw the show. I will make rough notes, but I'll write it the next morning. Because your opinion can change.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's been a challenging piece, sometimes I've not been able to work out why I thought it didn't work. And sometimes I don't work that out till ages after, when I thought, oh, of course, it was really badly directed. You know, that thought kind of enters my head, because I'm trying to live the experience. But also, I want to be an audience member. I don't want to miss a laugh because I'm writing something in the pad. I want to laugh with everyone else.
You're taking it all in, like just an ordinary member of the audience and then remembering it.
But it does help to go with
a
theatre buddy. I will admit, it does help to have somebody to bounce thoughts off afterwards. Because sometimes I've watched things and honestly, I think, what have I just watched? I don't understand that.
So but I've bounced views off other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So I think your reviews are great, and I mean, you must be looking forward to getting back to seeing shows again, as we all are.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to get on to a few of your foibles, idiosyncrasies, and maybe some of the stranger things that you've done. Now, you did review a show in the nude.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, can you tell us about that?
This was in Edinburgh, before anybody starts booking me for special nights. There was a show in Edinburgh, and it was a musical, and it was all about body image. I forget the title of the show, but it was very good. And I booked to review it, not knowing this. And then I had an email from the production company going, just to let you know, you've booked on the clothing optional performance, because it's about nudity and body image. You don't have to wear clothes to come and see that performance. And I thought, how often am I going to get the chance to review a show in the nude? And I'm in Edinburgh and nobody knows me. So I'm going to do it.
You whipped him all off.
Yeah. And it was bloody cold.
Yes.
It was freezing. Yeah, after about half an hour, I was really regretting the decision.
And you put something on your seat. You didn't sit bare bum on.
Oh, no, it wasn't bare bum. No, I think they give you a cushion or something, which was like destroyed afterwards.
Staying on the theme of nudity, if we may, tell us about your performance in the Full Monty.
Well, I'm actually
not the Full Monty show, but you did a Full Monty song as part of a sketch type.
Yeah, I mean,
show.
This was we did a charity night at Headgate to raise money for Mind, And I think charity performances are going to be absolutely essential in the next couple of years, at least, if not for longer. And we needed a big finish, basically. I mean, the response that we got, again, from the local community, because I was in the Mercury Theatre training program, the early careers, which I got into because, for me, writing is kind of an early career. And they really pushed us out of our comfort zone. And one of the things that we had to do was stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. So
I was coming to that.
Well, but... I did this stand-up routine. Thank you. When we were putting together the comedy night, we had lots of people who wanted to do a stand-up show. And we wanted, you know, people to sing and things like that. And I just suggested, why don't we do the full Monty? Because, you know, that the whole thing is about mental health.
Yeah.
We can destroy people's mental health by dancing nude in front of them. But I found four fellow performers who were...
Name them for this podcast.
Ben Matham, Joel Ely, Jonathan Davis, and Shane Whitworth.
Okay.
And we found a choreographer in Adam Woodhouse. Uh-huh. And we did, you know, to You Can Keep Your Hat On.
You Can Keep Your Hat On. By your fellow Welshman.
By the legend.
The legend.
Another Welsh legend, indeed, Tom Jones.
Who performed at the Castle Park very recently.
Yeah, he's great live, isn't he? So the climax of our comedy now, and it was actually a very, very funny version of the full Monty, because we had this routine, but, you know, the kind of Velcro kept coming apart, and I think we gave the audience a good laugh. But if you've actually seen the film, you don't really see anything in the film. Okay. It stops when they throw their hats into the audience. So we had a very careful choreographed blackout. Richard Bland was the man who, if he did not press that button,
would not be with us today,
creating the work that he has created since.
Yes,
but it was tremendous fun. And I tell you something, it was liberating, and I would do it again.
Would you?
Yeah, I would.
There's an offer to us.
As long as it's to raise money for charity. And I'm going to say I will do it again. Not on my own.
No.
But honestly, it was a really great and fun thing to do. Terrifying. Just before we did it, we were all regretting it. But
you didn't afterwards.
Yeah, not afterwards. And so I think that was before I reviewed the play in the nude. The
final thing I want to talk about is that during that, you must have revealed your tattoos.
Yes.
So tell us about some of your tattoos.
Well, again, a lot of people don't know that I'm tattooed. Well, you do. And so did everyone who saw the full Monty. I have a bear on my right shoulder, which represents me and my husband, because it has our initials in it. I have a dragon on my Welsh, and it's not totally Welsh, but obviously represents Wales, which started off small, but then as I got more confident about being tattooed, it's now a bigger dragon. My pride and joy is Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas, and I have an illustration of that on half my back. I have the two faces of the theatre, but they're in a locket. And one represents tragedy and has my favourite playwright, one of my favourite playwrights, Samuel Beckett, which is No Matter, Try Again, Fail Better, around the tragedy. And in the comedy, it's All the World's a Stage by Shakespeare. And I have Tales of the City, Armistead Maupin. So I have a San Francisco cable car with the rainbow flag on it. So my identity is now on my skin, really.
And I think on that note, it's a great place to finish. Paul, that has been wonderful.
Thank you
so much for joining me. Join us again for the next Cultural Colchester podcast.